Lots and lots and lots all joined together. Okay? So, this chromosome has a lot of DNA and a lot of protein. The nucleic acids are called DNA. The proteins are called histones. Just remember that the proteins associated with chromosomes are histones. If you have histones, you don't have DNA. DNA and histones make up a chromosome. If I tell you you have a histone, I'm talking about a chromosome. I'm not just talking about DNA. Here we see some of that DNA, the double helix, and we saw the A bonding to T, G bonding to C. See that double helix? I'll talk about that structure a little bit later. We've got the double helix wrapping around these proteins, these histones, tightly, tightly, tightly. Then these histones tightly wound into the telomeres of the chromatids. All right, and these chromosomes, they're hanging out in the nuclei. DNA. We're finally going to start talking in detail about the construction of those nucleic acids. We talk about those four big biomolecules. We talk a lot about the construction of protein, a lot about the construction of lipids. We talk a lot about the construction of carbohydrates. I barely touched on nucleic acids. We're finally going to see what these guys are made of. All right, what these things are made of. We've got a nitrogenous base, a pentose sugar. So what does pentose mean? Five carbon sugar. And we have a phosphate group. Hey, we've seen phosphates before, right? Phosphate groups. So we've got a phosphate group. With these nitrogenous bases, you either have purines or pyrimidines. These purines and pyrimidines, these nitrogenous bases are A, T, C, and G. We talk about those in lab. We have two types, okay, two subdivisions, purines, pyrimidines. Okay, so, I need to do this. Two ring, one ring. Purines, two ring, pyrimidines are one ring. Purines are G and A. Pyrimidines are C, T, and a new one we're going to call U, uracil. Uracil is only present in RNA. It's only present in RNA. It's how we will tell the difference automatically between DNA and RNA. So we've got purines, which are two rings, pyrimidines, which are one ring. We learned the Star Wars method in lab, right? Star Wars method for Chartoff's rule. Which letters go together? C, G, and A, T. Okay? Those work together. This is DNA. When we look at the C, how many rings does the C have? How big is C? One ring. C is one ring. How big is G? Two rings. How big is A?
Two rings.
And, two rings. And then how big is T? This, we will find, is how we actually have that DNA structure. How we keep that DNA to be a specific width apart. Matching a two ring with a one ring. A two ring with a one ring. That's why we're going to find that uracil takes the place of one of these one rings, one of the other one rings. It takes the place of T in RNA. But how in the world did we figure all this out? How did we figure out the size of these things? How did we figure out how they bound together? Two guys named Watson and Crick get the credit. They get the credit. There was X-ray diffraction data from a woman called, scientist called Rosalind Franklin. She'd been working with this, trying to figure out what was going on. Long story short, you can shoot X-rays of things and how they bounce off gives you information. She was working with this data. They used something else that they found called Chargaff's rule. Okay, this rule showed that the amount of A equaled the amount of T, and the amount of C equaled the amount of G. That showed which two bound together. The next thing they did, they used Tinker Toys. They literally got out their cans of Tinker Toys, dumped them out, and tried to figure out a way to make all this make sense. They got the Nobel Prize in 62 for this. They had to share it with the co-worker of Rosalind Franklin because she was deceased. She did not receive the Nobel Prize for the work that she pretty much died for. That X-ray damage, X-ray will damage your DNA. They tried, I won't go too far into that, but they got most, if not all, of the credit. She did not get the credit that she probably deserved because it was pretty much equal parts. But they went one step forward further, so they are our second group of real biologists of genius. They're our second one in our series. As a pair of lonely guys with their Tinker Toys, they compiled the works of others and took it just one step further. They found the structure of DNA and hence won the Nobel Prize. So they went that one more step. These guys, all these people will probably be on the exam in some way or another. So remembering that Rosalind Franklin used the X-ray diffraction, Chargaff, you better believe Chargaff's rule will be on the exam. I've talked about it at least 3 times already today. Okay, and I'll talk about it more. Then we've got Watson and Crick themselves. They will certainly be on them. Nobel Prize winners. Yeah, we try to put those on. So Chargaff's rule. Or with Chargaff, he noticed that the percentage of adenosine and thymine always equaled out, and then guanine and cytosine always equaled out. This led to the conclusion that they must be tied together, bonding together. But we've got all this sitting here, we've got all this information sitting here. We finally figure out the structure of DNA, but that doesn't tell us everything. It doesn't tell us actually all that much. Once we know the structure, we can start breaking it down to try and figure out how it actually codes. So how does it code for genes? We only have 4 letters to work with in our alphabet. We've got 4 words with these 4 letters. Only 4 letters, we've got to make words. Each stretch of DNA codes for protein. There are at least 30,000 different genes. Each one is a recipe for an enzyme. So at least 30,000 different stretches of DNA, each one coding for an enzyme. Proteins are strands of amino acids. We have 20 different amino acids that we humans use. All of a sudden, it doesn't seem like those letters are doing enough for us. Each individual letter isn't enough to code for each individual amino acid. We need more. We need a whole lot more. So we can't just say each letter is each protein or each amino acid in that protein chain. Each letter has to be with another letter at least. So if we pair 2 letters together, how many could we code? First off, we could code for 4. We need to code for 20. If we use 2 letter words, how many can we code for? 16. For each first letter, there are 4 possible second letters. For each letter, there's 4 possible seconds. So it's 4 times 4, 16. So if we use 2 letter words, we can code for 16 possibilities. Is that enough? Nope. So what do we go with? 3. There are 64 different possible combinations. We only really need 20, but that gives us some leeway for mutation. By the end of lecture, we're going to practice translating proteins from DNA. I'm going to put DNA up, and you're going to be able to translate it into a protein. Let's look a little bit more at the structure. Each one of these winds around itself. Each of these strands are complementary. C always equals G, A always equals T, T always equals A, so on and so forth. As I was saying before, they're almost mirroring strands. We have a phosphate end and an OH end on each side of the DNA. That's important as well. This is how the DNA is angled. Remember when we were talking about those DNases in lab? There, I had it as a 5-3. One side was a 5, one side was a 3. That's what it's talking about. The 5N ends with a phosphate group. The 3N ends with an OH. That's how we determine those sides. If you know one side of the strand, you can automatically find the other.
That's important. We're going to use that for DNA. We're going to use that to build extra DNA, to copy our DNA. We're going to use that to write down proteins. We're going to use that to make RNA.
We're going to use and abuse that. We've got these sides of the ladder that are made up of these two groups, sides of the DNA ladder. The nitrogenous bases are the rungs of the ladder. So this,
you have a ladder, the rung is what you grab onto, climb up the ladder.
We climb right up the DNA ladder, even though it's at this weird angle. So, we did this in lab. We're going to do it again in lecture. We're going to keep doing it because
we're going to have to do it on the exam.
These are good, fun little questions on the exam. So, what would C bond to? G. Everybody. T?
A.
T.
T-A-C-A.
All right. Okay. So these gene stretches of DNA code for enzymes. Each enzyme makes a chemical reaction happen, and that's how genes affect you. Okay? That's how genes change who and how you are. I was talking about, I've come here from Ohio, I have trouble adjusting to the heat. I don't necessarily grab the right enzyme. I have it, or at least I should have it in my DNA, but I don't always write off the correct enzyme. Okay, I don't always access it. So, how do genes code for us? Why are identical twins basically identical? Why are these almost exactly the same? They're only almost exactly the same if they have the same genes. Same exact genes, same exact person. Who could tell the Olsen twins apart? That's right, you couldn't. How about now? Sure you can. One looks a little bit too thin, and the other one, it looks all right, right?
Why? That's a physical environmental choice that one is made.
Okay? That is an environmental factor. Not feeding yourself is an environmental factor. That's not a genetic difference. One can be different than the other, but genetically they're the same. Anyway, why are traits linked? Remember, we only have 23 chromosomes and thousands of genes. How do we link these up? Well, there's only so much space. If genes are on the same chromosome, they're all going to be tied together. That's why we have chromosomes that tell us what sex we are. One chromosome carries all the information we need to determine that one sex. That's a lot of difference, right? There's a lot of differences between each sex. Think about the other 22 pairs of chromosomes and how much difference must be included in each of those to make you function. We talked about not having enough chromosomes, having too many.
These differences are huge. All right, we see a very large amount of difference between this. When we have too many chromosomes, way too much information.
It's not just a little too much information, all right? It's way too much information. If you don't have enough, again, nowhere near enough information. Very rarely do you survive. Like I said, it's like building a bridge. Too much information, too much weight on the bridge. You build too much bridge collapses. You try and build a bridge without enough information, bridge doesn't meet in the middle, somebody drives off the bridge. Not good. Gotta work out. Genetic recombination is something that we'll see not only in how people can have different traits, but things that should have been tied together are now tied a little differently.
You can jump one piece to another, one piece of a chromosome to another chromosome.
This also is something we see a lot in speciation. We'll talk about that in ecology. When new species develop, sometimes it's because of genetic recombination. Every nitrogenous base, the nitrogenous bases are the rungs on the ladder. The stretch of DNA is a gene.
Okay? So one half of the ladder going up. A section of rungs on the ladder.
How are we going to get these enzymes from DNA when we already know that DNA absolutely never leaves the nucleus? Alright, we looked at that in lab today. DNA, it isn't leaving that nucleus. This is a safe little house for it. It is not exiting. It's going to send somebody else to go get beat up. DNA is too important. It's too valuable. You cannot possibly let it be damaged. When it's damaged, that's when you have a mutation. A mutation. We're going to talk about mutations in a second. These mutations can do nothing, or they can do really bad things. Really, really bad things. So, we have to protect that DNA, okay? It's got to stay in its house, and we've got to protect that house, okay? We've got to protect it. So what do? We send out lackeys. We send out people we don't care about. We send out RNA. We send somebody else to go do it. We make a copy of the gene from the DNA. The copy is the RNA. We then send the RNA out of the nucleus. If it gets hurt, it only we'll make a new copy if we have to. We'll make another copy. But it's not the DNA that's hurt. Before I go into how this transcription and translation happened, I'm going to go back to mutation for a moment. Okay? I'm going to talk about mutation. So these mutations are alterations of the genetic code. Something comes in, hits it, and changes it. This can be damage from sunlight photons, it can be damage from x-rays, it can be damage from carcinogens that you take in through your breath, alright? As long as it gets in there and damages the DNA, it doesn't matter what it is. Now, what else did we learn? We learned that DNA is very fragile. Almost anything can harm DNA. It's very fragile. It's sitting and bonding together by hydrogen bonds down the center. This is not the strongest structure we've ever made in our bodies. So it's very, very wimpy. That's why we protect it so much. But a lot of things are carcinogens. A lot. Tumors, if you have a tumor, it's a solid cell mass. It's only a tumor when it's an inappropriate solid cell mass. This is when you have cells dividing out of control. There is a line of mutations that happen to produce cancer. Cancer is only your body producing extra cells. One mitotic cell was told it could do whatever it wants and divide as much as it wants, and it will. It will take every bit of energy it possibly can to do that. It will do everything in its power because it thinks it, well, it doesn't think, but that is what it's supposed to do. Okay? That's what it's supposed to do. This is not malicious. It's not trying to hurt you. It thinks it's doing its job. It doesn't think it. It is doing what it's allowed to do. A benign tumor is one that remains confined to a single area. Benign tumor, right there. It's not spreading. Benign tumors are usually non-fatal, unless, of course, they're in areas that are very constricted in space, like your skull, right? Benign means non-harmful, all right? Usually. But if you have a benign tumor on your brain, or multiple, like mine off, it's still very, very, very bad. Because what is it doing? Growing. There's a very constricted amount of space in here. You don't want any giant balls of cells in there pushing your brain out of its space. Very bad. So while benign tumors, the only real statement about a benign tumor is that it stays restricted to a single area, are usually thought of as the good tumor, they can still be very damaging. They have to be dealt with. Because they can eventually become malignant tumors. Malignant tumors can send cells out to proliferate elsewhere in the body. Not only does this cell say, hey, I can double as much as I want here, I'm going to send a buddy out to go double over there.
That's bad.
Because these things, where are they going to get caught? Things that get lots of blood.
Brain, heart, lung,
digestive system, places you're not going to find them,
and they're going to kill you. These are things that are competing with you for your resources. You don't want that.
And they will actively, and I'll talk more about how they do, actively ask for more resources, and your body will give them to them. And your body will give them to them because your body thinks it's supposed to. But we'll talk more about that in anatomy physiology.
So, malignant is when it can send out those cells. Benign is when they stay constricted and confined. Okay? Both of these can be very bad. It just matters. It just matters where they are. We're going to talk about the mutations in general for just a second. A neutral mutation and a point mutation.
Neutral mutation means no change. Neutral. Absolutely no change in the mutation. A point mutation makes a major difference in the chain. It's going to change what nucleic acid you put in that place. A neutral mutation doesn't change what nucleic acid you put in that slot, right? You have the primary structure and the secondary, right? So this primary structure, neutral doesn't change it. Point changes it. All of a sudden it's thumb instead of finger, right? That's not right. Something's going to be wrong. That can cause this enzyme to do many different things. There are a long line of mutations that you have to have in order to get cancer. But in order to misform an enzyme, sometimes it can be as little as a single point mutation. One point mutation can mess up an enzyme.
There are dangerous types of enzymes, enzymes that break down the wrong things.
Luckily for us, they're very, very rare, unless you're a cannibal. If you are a cannibal, these enzymes don't break down as normal. They're very hard to break down. You can ingest them, and in some people who have them, they're just fine with them. They've had them all their lives. But if you haven't, they can break down and destroy your brain. Kind of. Yeah, it's a misformed protein. Mad cow was. It's a misformed enzyme.
So red meat in general, or red meat that is the same?
Just you. Okay. Just you and I, right? If it's the same thing, that's when it's actually dangerous. Otherwise, it's not a problem. And most cannibals aren't really cooking. Right? You're not catching the guy and cooking him. You're usually just catching the guy, right? So, that is why we usually really, really frown on cannibalism, at least in the biological sense, okay? In the social and moral sense, stuff I don't talk about, right? There are whole other reasons to be upset about it. But why don't we see it in the animal kingdom? Because of those possible problems with it. You see very little cannibalization. You see it in sharks.
You see it in monkeys are beginning to do it too.
Monkeys will usually eat different types of monkeys. We'll talk about the bonobo later. And their hunting parties. But it's more of a war thing. It's more, I'm killing this infant so that it can't later have children. But they'll catch smaller monkeys that are, there are people who eat monkeys.
So it's really you have to worry when it's you. That the bigger problems show up. It may and it may not. Okay, so cancer. We're going to go back to cancer. Okay? We're going to go back to cancer. Yeah, sometimes I go on tangents that apply to your life. Sometimes I go on tangents that you may not initially realize apply to your life, but really and truly, cannibalism not being a social norm applies to your life. It changes how you are, right? It changes how our society is. Anyway, so cancer, why doesn't your body just destroy it? The answer is 6 out of 7 times it does. Most times it does. You will get cancer about 7 times over the course of your life. Most people will destroy it because it will misform those proteins that sit outside and say, hey, I'm you. When it makes a mistake and it no longer says, hey, I'm you, your immune system says, hey, you're not me. Gone. All right? You're out of here.
It's when that mutation gets lucky and doesn't change that outside, if it doesn't change that high on you, your body doesn't see it as anything but you. So if it doesn't make that mistake, you won't catch it. That's why it's so hard to destroy cancer. So how do we stop, what do we do to get rid of cancer? Chemotherapy. What are the two things we do? If you have radiation, chemo, tumor removal.
Yeah.
Right? First thing we do is we get rid of the big mass of cells. Okay? Take that big ball and throw it away. Right? This is bad. So we cut you open, we take that tumor out, gone. Next thing, we fill you full of poison. Chemotherapy and radiation, they are designed to just kill cells. That's what they do. Okay? They're designed to destroy your cells. They're just designed to go after the cells that are proliferating, that are going through mitosis the most often. That doesn't always mean it only goes after the cancer cells. Why does chemo hurt people? Why does it weaken people so much?
Because it hits your whole body.
Because it's everything. It's everything. If those cells are dividing, it kills them. Doesn't care. Because you never know where those cells may have gone. In a malignant tumor, in malignant cancer, you don't know where they are. I could have one out of my pinky, right? Out of my pinky finger. I gotta kill it. You can't discriminate. Anything that's dividing quickly has to go. What else is going to be working really, really hard when you're really, really sick?
Your
immune system. So that's why we have a lot of problems. People get really sick on chemo. People have really hard times on chemo.
It's really 50-50 shot.
It's tough. It may work, it may not. So what are we doing with radiation? We're bombarding that area with X-rays or whatever rays, okay? Some kind of radioactive wave. What are we doing there? We're screwing up its DNA so much that hopefully it dies. So that's the joke. We're just pounding it so hard, making it mutate so much that it dies. What's that also going to do? Kill whatever's in the way, right? Whatever part of you is in the way, getting hit with that radiation, is going to have a hard time too. So, we're always working on cancer treatments. We're going to talk a little bit later on in the class about why curing cancer isn't really something we can go for. We can fix it when you have cancer, but if we actually got rid of, prevented ourselves from being able to get cancer, we would kill the human race. Gone. We would destroy the human race. Do I hate that stuff? Sure. Do I think we need to get rid of cancer? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It has to exist. You can get rid of it. I mean, as it comes down to, you can chop that tumor out, then you can zap it. Zap any of the extra cells out there and be cured. Alright? It can just be gone. Okay? It can go away. It's just sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't. You're shooting fish in a barrel. Alright? Sometimes a fish gets away. You can screen for it. You can sometimes find those mutations before they happen. That's why we have cancer screenings. When we look at normal cells and problem cells in the lab, I think it's next week, we'll look at some cancer cells. We'll look at how different they are. And we'll talk about very deadly forms of cancer. My grandmother who died of brain cancer had previously had breast cancer and survived it. Much more common, but very, very dangerous. We need to remember this Chargaff's rule. We're going to use it to translate. We're going to use it to translate. And we are going to be translating on the exam. All right? We're going to need to be able to replicate strands of DNA on the exam. We're going to need to be able to translate proteins on the exam. Okay? It seems harder than it really is. We're just going to use three-letter words. These three-letter words are, and this is something that I want to make sure you guys hear, all right? These three-letter words are codons, okay? Each three nitrogenous bases
are a codon. Why are they called a codon? Because they've got a code on them. All right? Three, it's a codon. They got a code on them. Okay? All right? They're a codon. All right? We're going to use that to build these long chains of amino acids that will then turn into big globular proteins.